Today we need to continue in alkenes. So we had begun simple electrophilic addition, and then we had begun oxymercuration, demercuration. Now those of you in section two, the reaction with bromine, Br2, which we had covered in lab lecture, is a reaction that is extraordinarily similar to the mercury reaction. So section two, I'll review that bromine reaction in lab today. That will be part of lecture notes once we get to that part in lab. But I won't describe it here again. Now, Friday, if once you've reviewed your notes, you have questions about the bromine reaction, of course, I'm going to answer those questions. But where I've discussed this ring that's formed in the mercury reaction, exactly the same type of arguments would come up in the ring that's formed when Br2 reacts. So let's go back to this oxymercuration, demercuration then, working with the same alkene that we had previously, which I chose this alkene only because we do end up with stereocenters at both the positions of where the double bond had been once the reaction proceeds. You might remember that we have this reagent mercury acetate, and just to save time in writing the structure, I'm going to continue using the AC abbreviation for acyl, meaning carbonyl with a methyl group on it. The first reaction step, I had talked about how there's different ways to write it, but the way that we ended up doing it was to show an alkene attacking mercury, a pair of electrons in response coming back to make a ring. At the same time, one of the acetate groups is kicked off. There are two intermediates that are formed. Let me give myself more room to do this. They don't settle down in a minute. I'll go use my professorly voice on them. So this ring compound, we'd already gone over how there's going to be two different forms that form because the mercury could sit down on one face or the other of the double bond. And what I ran through at the end of the lecture the other day is what's going to happen next. Because there are only two eventual products that end up forming in this reaction. And there's an attack specifically at the tertiary center. And I think I even pointed that aspect of the next step out on Monday. But that's going to be somewhat an unusual step. Because at the same time, the ring opens. Or let me turn that around. The ring does not open until the attack occurs, which is why there are only two products that form. If this ring were to open before the next attack could occur, then you could effectively end up with four different products because we already have these two intermediates. If the ring was to open to form formally a carbocation, attack of that carbocation could again happen from two different sides, which means we have four products, much like we had with the first type of electrophilic addition. The whole point of this reaction is because it maintains its ring form until the next attack occurs, that's why there's only two eventual products that form. Yes?
Does this one actually form four?
No, this one actually does only form two. The exception where you could form four, where that ring could open on its own, is a situation that we ended up with in the lab. Now, in fact, before I finish this mechanism, let me go ahead and write that what down, because that is a very important stereochemical point. In this reaction, the ring remains intact until it is attacked by whatever nucleophile is present in solution. Because the ring remains intact,
each intermediate. Will only produce one product. Now, to remind ourselves that aspect of what we discussed in lab. In lab, we had this case. We had a cyclobromonium ion. Same type of deal as we have with the cyclomercurinium ion. And what can happen, though, in this case, is the ring can open by itself. Shouldn't use a dash there anymore because it's not a stereo center anymore because it's planar. In this case, the ring can open independently only because the formation of a benzyl carbocation is favorable. Only in this case, or ones like it, attack can occur from two different directions. Going back to our main focus, this mercury reaction, the next step that will occur is that water will come in and push open that ring. And so we'll get two products, and only two products. Yes. Well, and actually, if we go back into lab notes and review this very specific case, we don't form four products only because two of them are the same compound because they're meso. But if this was not a symmetric compound, then yes, by having the benzene ring there, you would, in theory, form four products versus the only two products that we're getting in this case. Now, we'll, of course, have a deprotonation. And so we'll end up with two products. Notice that what did add in the water added in at the most substituted position. So this is a form of Markovnikov addition. So, in fact, let me write, make a note of that. Now the question is, though, why does it attack at this most substituted position? Because if we have, let me scoot this down momentarily, if we do have this concerted attack of water on that ring, and if both of those events are occurring simultaneously, it looks like it's an SN2-style reaction. Well, SN2 shouldn't be possible at tertiary substrates. So what's going on? Well, this is a positively charged three-membered ring, which is fairly unstable. It's going to want to react. And essentially what happens is one of the two bonds is weaker than the other in this case. Because one of the bonds is to a tertiary carbon, where once the ring opens, if a carbocation forms, that would be the most favorable place to have the carbocation. That means that the bond to that position is a bit weaker compared to the bond from mercury that had been there, that had been to the secondary carbon, which ends up being stronger because the secondary carbon doesn't want to have the carbocation. And so it's not as favorable to break that bond, which means the bond is stronger. So one bond is longer and weaker because the carbocation that could form would be favorable. The other bond is shorter and stronger because that carbocation is not favorable. The positive charge itself is what is allowing the ring to be pushed open, and so sterics don't really have an influence here. So addition of water occurs at the most substituted position. This might seem strange, given that the mechanism of that step resembles an SN2 reaction and involves a tertiary substrate. But again, if we look at the intermediate, and let's say that I stylize it in this way, I simplify and just focus on the fact that I have a tertiary versus a secondary substrate. And again, what's happening is the three-membered ring is strained due to its small size and the positive charge. When the ring opens, is more favorable to produce a tertiary versus secondary carbocation, so the bond to the tertiary carbon is weaker, and therefore breaks when water attacks. Now there's one more step in this reaction, in fact. We're not to the end yet. Because if you went back and reviewed, this discussion started by mentioning, you know, we might want to make an alcohol out of a particular alkene, but what if that alkene is subject to carbocation rearrangement during the reaction? So I said, well, here's this alternate method for making an alcohol. And notice we do have an OH group on the products that we formed, but we still have this mercury around. So this next step you don't have to know the mechanism for. Taking just one of the products, reduce the amount of writing we're doing, you'd simply be able to say sodium borohydride and base. No mechanism necessary. And what happens is we remove the mercury. Now, it is thought that that reduction might actually be radical in nature, and what ends up happening is the stereochemistry, therefore, is lost at that position. But before that step had occurred, notice that the mercury, which was one of the things added in this reaction, and the OH group, they are pointed opposite directions from each other. And that's, again, because you had this ring that was maintained while water did the attack. So the first step of the reaction, I had said, occurred with syn addition, because the ring formed only on one side or the other of the double bond. But the overall mechanism is anti-addition, because the two groups end up facing opposite ways. So I don't think we've done the six aspects, the six features of this reaction. So the utility is to convert an alkene into an alcohol if you use water, or ether if you do the same reaction with an alcohol being present instead. The reagents. First, it's mercury acetate and water or an alcohol. Two, it's followed up by the sodium borohydride and hydroxide. As far as conditions, there aren't going to be any special conditions that I show for this reaction. The mechanism, it is cationic and stepwise overall. At the end here, yes, we did have a nucleophile come in to attack, but it's attacking that that cyclomercurinium ion. And it's the formation of that cyclomercurinium ion that's the tough part of the reaction. So that's why I'm still classifying this as cationic. In terms of stereochemistry, you'll form enantiomers, not diastereomers in this case. It's exactly because the ring stays closed that we don't make diastereomers. Now I say, can it forms enantiomers? There'll be cases where maybe you don't end up with stereocenters at all. But otherwise it can form enantiomers, yes. And then regiochemistry. Again, the advantage of this reaction is that it is Markovnikov addition. No carbocation rearrangement, because you don't ever form a carbocation. Items 4, 5, and 6 are exactly the same for the bromination reaction. So even though I said it wouldn't cover the bromination reaction again specifically, let's at least walk through the conditions and reagents. And before we do that, even, I got to come back and say, if we had this initial example molecule, this is the one where I said a problem occurs if we try to do simple electrophilic addition. If I want to show not the mechanism, but just synthesis, then I could write it like this. The one and two are critical here. They mean do everything with the first set of reagents entirely in the absence of the second set. Then, once you've either isolated the intermediate or quenched the initial set of reagents, only then do you use the second set of reagents. So this specifies the order of addition of reagents and that they must be done as two separate steps. Yeah. HG, mercury. HG, H2O. NaOH, NaBH4. HG, mercury acetate. HG, parentheses, OAC, parentheses, 2. The structure of the reagent is right here, by the way. These numbers indicate the reagents must be used in a specific order as separate steps. Now, the bromine reaction, just to summarize. This is a somewhat poor example because only one position ends up with a stereocenter, but this still would occur with the same kind of overall anti-stereochemistry that we have. In fact, I'll show you another better example in just a moment. But the utility is to convert an alkene to a vicinal dihalide. Do you remember what the word vicinal means? Neighboring. So the two bromines on neighboring carbons. This is an important reaction because as you're doing in lab today, you can then take a vicinal dihalide, and if it's the right kind of vicinal dihalide, make an alkyne out of it, which we'll see the mechanism for that on Monday. The reagents. Bromine. Or it turns out chlorine can also undergo that reaction. The conditions, no light. Now pull your list back down, go up to number 5 from the mercury action. And throw this note in about it having overall anti-addition. For bromination, items 5 and 6 then are the same as oxymercuration, demercuration. Now let me show you a slightly better example with bromination, and let me show you a variation. It's the formation of a compound called a halohydrin. And I'll actually show you the full mechanism for this then. I'll use the same contrived alkene that we've had before. If I show you the reagents as being bromine, but not just bromine, bromine with water present as a solvent, water will far outpopulate the bromine, which has the following effect. As the reaction goes on, start out with the bromine that gets attacked by the alkene. We make the two cyclic intermediates. Oops, only two lone pairs. And now at this point, because you have so much water around, instead of bromide coming intact, which is the way that we saw it happen in lab, water will be the one that comes to attack. Because water attacked, we have a deprotonation step. And so we'll end up with two products, which are an alcohol that's right next to the bromine. Notice that again, the bromine and the alcohol that result occur in overall anti-addition. And a halohydrin, let me define it, is a molecule that contains both an alcohol and a halide. This is a particularly sneaky reaction, and what I'm about to show you isn't actually part of this quarter, but I want to link this to an easy thing we'll talk about next quarter. If I take one of these halohydrins, and I throw a particular kind of base at it, sodium hydride. Hydride tends to be basic without being as nucleophilic, so it can successfully deprotonate the alcohol. Well, that means we now have an alkoxide. Well, look what we have right next door, a leaving group. Well, since this is a single bond between the two different carbons, That's free to rotate, and at some point the oxygen and bromine can end up anti-periplanar to each other. Which if they do, you have an intramolecular SN2 reaction. And it forms a functional group called an epoxide. Even though the specific trick is not something until next quarter, I wanted to show it to you. One, just to show you, there are such things as intramolecular SN2 reactions. But we're going to see another mechanism that will take us straight from an alkene to a epoxide. So, covered a lot so far this morning. So let me ask if you have questions about, more about the mercuration-demercuration reaction. But since I've shown a mechanism again, if you have questions about the bromination reaction. Okay, so we've seen one reaction of making an alcohol, which is just to cook an alkene in water and acid. We've seen a second way of making an alcohol, where it will have Markovnikov addition without carbocation rearrangement, and that's oxymercuration demercuration. But wouldn't it be great if there was some way to be able to take an alkene and have it undergo anti-Markovnikov addition, where something happens so that we could put the alcohol on the less substituted position? This is called anti-Markovnikov addition because the substituent ends up on the less substituted carbon. And it turns out there is such a reaction. You first use a compound called borane, BH3. You follow that up with sodium hydroxide in hydrogen peroxide. And this reaction is called hydroboration oxidation. Let's see what this mechanism is, because it is unusual. It is your third type of alkene mechanism. So type 1, plain electrophilic addition. Type 2, forming cyclic intermediates, which is what bromine and mercury did. Type 3, and this is the only reaction in type 3 that we're going to learn. Borane, which a little story about borane. It is one heck of a reactive chemical. That is perfectly synthesizable, but you squirt it out into open atmosphere, instantly would catch on fire. Why? Because it so violently reacts with water that's in the air. Why would that happen? Why would this be such a hot compound? What about the octet? It doesn't have one, does it? But if you were to do formal charges, this molecule is neutral. It just happens to be that boron, because it can just be trivalent, it doesn't have to follow the octet rule. But that's going to mean that boron is going to be particularly reactive in molecules that have only three connections, as we have here. Now, THF, that stands for tetrahydrofuran. Which, have I mentioned TAF before? THF, I mean? No. Okay. So, furan is this molecule. It's a cyclic molecule that has two double bonds in it. And it's got quite unusual reactivity. Put four hydrogens on there, though, get rid of the double bonds, and that's how you get tetrahydrofuran, THF. You could see that it's structurally effectively just the cyclic cousin of diethyl ether, your common lab solvent. If you take the two carbon chains on either side and join them together in a ring, well, that is THF. Why is THF mentioned in this reaction? Because THF will form a complex with borane. It won't react per se because it doesn't make a product that can do anything further. But it helps to satisfy boron's intense need for electrons. And it makes the compound easier to ship. So because borane is so electron deficient, you often don't buy it just as itself. You buy it as the complex. Now, this complex is still amazingly reactive. So it's not that you can throw it around. It just does it. It does make it more handleable. Now, what does borane do? Something quite unusual. Borane forms all these very complicated structures because it is one of the few cases in which hydrogens can be shared between more than one atom. So in fact, borane is normally found as the borane dimer, which looks like the following. One, two, three. Sorry, not enough hydrogens. Four, five, six. But this shouldn't be able to exist in some senses because hydrogen really should only be able to have one bond. And really, if we get into the technical analysis of this, this is one bond that's shared between two atoms. So quite unusual structure. You could say each one's really a half bond. Yes.
So there's no
antibond present, no. Anytime you have a bonding orbital, you in principle have an antibonding orbital, but they're not actually there. It's just what I'm trying to get at is it's something unusual. Now, don't get too hung up on this because what I'm really leading to is why has borane got unusual reactivity? Well, in the same way it's able to make these structures that are quite unusual, it's got an unusual transition state it goes through. So here's how the mechanism starts. Hydrogen-boron bond reacts. At the same time, an alkene attacks boron. Why would the alkene attack boron? Because it's electron deficient. But at the same time that happens, the hydrogen goes back to attack the alkene. That means we're going to go through this four-centered transition state. Now, whenever I ask you to write the mechanism for this reaction, normally I don't ask you to write transition states. I'm only doing it in this case so that we can learn about what happens in the borane reaction. Now, this is an unusual enough reaction that there are some presentations of this topic in terms of OChem textbooks that may last 10 or 20 pages. In fact, we used a text in the distant past that when it presented this reaction, it says, well, here's what might happen, but it's not. So here's what could happen instead. But that's not what happened because it's even trickier than that. So here's what happens. 20 pages later, the students ask me, well, what the hell happens? You know? So without trying to get lost in 20 pages of arguments, let me tell you why this in intermediate is significant. Because notice that boron is ending up at the less substituted position. The hydrogen, which in other additions we've seen, the hydrogen usually ends up at the less substituted position, and whatever else is adding in ends up at the more substituted position. So this would appear to be anti-Markovnikov addition. But what's more electronegative, hydrogen or boron? Hydrogen. Boron is less electronegative. So as far as where the delta plus is on this molecule, it's on boron. Boron is the electrophile. So the electrophile ends up at the less substituted position. That actually follows what the other electrophilic additions do. But it looks backwards because it's putting hydrogen, which happens to be, in comparison, the nucleophile, at the more substituted position. So let me write this part of it down. This reaction step appears to be anti-Markovnikov addition, since the hydrogen which normally is the electrophile ends up at the more substituted position. However, hydrogen is more nucleophilic, or sorry, electronegative. Than boron. So boron is the electrophile. Looking at that four-centered transition state then, if boron is really the critter that's electron deficient, then you could write a delta positive on the boron and a delta negative on the hydrogen. But if that's true, that means effectively you would be inducing or causing a delta positive on the more substituted carbon of the alkane, of what is becoming an alkane. So a carbocation never forms, but the concentration of positive charge occurs at the most substituted position, which is exactly what wants to happen. So it looks anti-Markovnikov, but that's because hydrogen happens to be the nucleophile in comparison in this reaction. So hydrogen is more electronegative than boron. Boron is the electrophile. Consequently, the boron adds to the less substituted position, and the hydrogen, well, we already said that, and the hydrogen ends up at the more substituted position. Because of this cyclic transition state, no carbocation forms, so no rearrangement occurs. So let me start the mechanism over again, now not showing the transition state, so you could see it the way that I would want you to write it. So, Alkene attacks boron. Hydrogen attacks back. You end up forming an alkyl borane. But if the hydrogen-boron bond was reactive once, why can't it be reactive twice? Which is exactly what happens. Another alkene will attack this same intermediate. And so now we'll form a dialkyl borane, which I can abbreviate the structure this way. But if the first two bonds could react, won't the third one? Of course. And so then you'll end up with a trialkyl borane. You might think, okay, we can handle that. Three times, same reaction, no big deal. It's what happens next that scares people. Because this is only part of the reaction. Now, we're low on time, so let me write the whole mechanism out so that you can start to make your flashcards, and I'll explain it more properly on Friday. The trialkyl borane is not isolated, but it's allowed to react with a mixture of sodium hydroxide and hydrogen peroxide. Hydrogen peroxide has a smaller pKa than water does, and so that means hydroxide can deprotonate hydrogen peroxide, and so the hydrogen peroxide ion attacks boron. When it does so, it does one of the single most unusual steps we're going to see this quarter in organic chemistry. Because forming a boron, oxygen, carbon bond, sequence of bonds, is favorable enough that to relieve the negative charge that ends up forming after the hydrogen peroxide attacks, the alkyl group will shift over and kick off hydroxide as a leaving group. It will kick off hydroxide, a base, as the leaving group. That's how favorable, though, this overall process is. It's kind of, sort of like a carbocation migration, except that we have anions involved instead. Moving on for now, just because of the lack of time. What you now have is a dialkyl monoalkoxy borane. You've effectively added an oxygen in at that position. This happens two more times. In exactly the same way that I abbreviated here, I will allow you to do on the exam. Now, if you're starting to think, wow, these mechanisms take a while to write, yeah, and you better be practicing writing them. Because this whole entire mechanism, once you know it, I expect you to be able to write out in under 5 minutes. Comfortably under 5 minutes, because it won't be the only question on the exam. To finish off, after this happens three times, you will end up with a trialkoxy borane. Oops, written incorrect. There is one more sequence of steps that I guess I'll have to finish out next time, because we're out of time. But it gets decomposed, and you end up with the alcohol. Overall, this is anti-Markovnikov addition. It's done in a sneaky way because we use borane, where the boron, being less electronegative, ends up at the less substituted position, and we then convert it into an alcohol. So we are out of time. We'll finish this off Friday.